From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In his new book, The Bush Tragedy, Jacob Weisberg writes that the relationship between President Bush and his father lies at the core of George W. Bush's failed presidency. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Weisberg about his book. He says it isn't an indictment of the president, it's an attempt to analyze what went wrong by examining the president in the context of his relationships with his family, his advisors, and his religion. Also, transforming an ill-equipped, untrained National Guard regiment from New York into a battle-ready unit. Sean Michael Flynn commanded two rifle companies in the Fighting 69th, which was propelled into action at Ground Zero after 9/11 and later sent to Iraq. Flynn has written a new book. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jacob Weisberg, is the editor-in-chief of the online magazine Slate and the author of the new book, The Bush Tragedy. He says the book isn't intended as an indictment. The book assumes Bush has failed as president, which is a sentiment Weisberg thinks even many conservatives share. Weisberg points to the war in Iraq as an example, which he describes as having squandered much of America's global leadership role, making the country weaker diplomatically, militarily, and economically. Weisberg's goal is to try and understand what went wrong in the Bush presidency by examining the president within the context of his relationships with his family, his advisors, and his religion. Weisberg thinks President Bush's relationship with his father is at the core of his presidency and its failures. I asked Weisberg why.
Well, I think it's evident in all sorts of Bush's actions. I think if you look at his life, you see really a very poignant story in many ways of someone growing up in the shadow of an incredibly powerful father, someone who was revered in the family, considered to be almost a kind of Superman. It's funny because people outside the family haven't always seen the elder Bush that way. But here was a man who was a talented athlete, a scholar, a war hero who went into the oil business, made a lot of money, did incredibly well, went into politics, was successful, good at everything he tried with this amazing sense of ease. And I think to be the son of a man like that is inevitably difficult. And for George W. Bush, it was particularly difficult because he didn't seem to have any of those skills. I think he wasn't particularly good at sports. He tried to do all of the things his father did, and in many cases created a kind of parody. You know, he went to the same schools, but he didn't do well. He went into the oil business and stumbled around. Instead of being a war hero, he was in the Air National Guard avoiding Vietnam. And I think you see this pattern where for the whole first part of his life, he's trying to do what his father did and failing at it. And I think it makes him very unhappy. I think it explains his drinking, among other things. And then I think he has this transformation, a kind of midlife crisis around the age of 40, where he stops drinking, he finds God, but perhaps more importantly, he somehow figures out how to differentiate himself from his father, to stop trying to do everything his dad did.
Do you think religion is an example of how he differentiated himself from his father?
Absolutely. In the Bush family, they're Episcopalians, and expressions of religious feeling are almost considered a kind of bad taste. And the son, George W., adopts evangelical style and evangelical beliefs that are very alien in the Bush family. It's one of a lot of ways in which I think he sort of takes his father as a starting point and defines himself in opposition.
Compare his style of leadership to his father's and what you think that reflects about their personalities.
Well, in terms of style, their decision-making, I think, really couldn't be any more different. The father, I had an interesting conversation with Brent Scowcroft about this when I was working on the book. The father, particularly in foreign policy, which is his passion, is methodical, detail-oriented, thorough, considered. He entertains inconclusive debate where there'll be people arguing on opposite sides, and he doesn't feel compelled to reach resolution right away. And very importantly, he's capable of changing his mind. The son has always prided himself on being just the opposite. In fact, he saw that style of decision-making of his father's as a kind of weakness of his father's, part of the reason he thinks his father was a failed president who didn't get reelected. Bush is, in his famous nickname he gave himself, the decider. He decides everything quickly. He doesn't need a lot of information. He doesn't want to hear a debate. He doesn't review his decisions much after he's made them, and he doesn't change his mind.
Now, you mentioned Brent Scowcroft, and Brent Scowcroft has been opposed to the war in Iraq right from the start and has been pretty critical of President George W. Bush, even though he was a close advisor to President Bush's father. And you say that George W. Bush never really got along with Scowcroft, never really liked him?
Somehow. George W. has been very hostile to Brent Scowcroft for a long time. And it's funny, if you look at the people around his father and decided who are you likely to have a personality clash with, Brent Scowcroft would be at the bottom of the list because he's a very nice man, warm, easy to get along with, generous. James Baker, maybe you could understand, he's a little more abrasive. But somehow, George W. has, I think, made Brent Scowcroft into this figure of opposition, someone who embodies his father's views that he rejects, but to whom he doesn't owe the affection and loyalty he owes his father. But I think it's been mystifying to Scowcroft. Scowcroft doesn't talk openly about this because he's very loyal to the father and to the whole family. But there's this tremendous hostility he radiates towards Scowcroft. And there I have a couple of scenes in the book where essentially the father is trying to use Scowcroft to get a message through to the son, first about why he thought going to Iraq was a bad idea. I think Scowcroft was very much speaking for the father about that. And then after the war, about how maybe to reverse course and do something about the way Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, was mismanaging things. And Bush reacts with utmost hostility to Scowcroft's meddling intervention.
Let's talk a little bit about President Bush and religion. You say that religion is one of the places in which the younger Bush really differentiated himself from his father. You describe President Bush as having a theology free of content, but being sophisticated and artful at applying religion to politics. In what way do you see the president's theology as being free of content?
Well, it's a kind of, when I started the book, I thought, when I understand George Bush's religious ideas, when I understand what he believes, I'll be much closer to understanding his policy, why he's done what he's done, who he is. And I found just the opposite in a way, that when you tried to pin down George W. Bush's religious beliefs, there really weren't very many of them. He believes in God. He believes it's good to believe in God. He believes that faith saved his life, that it helped him turn his life around. He believes faith has this transforming power for other people. But what is the faith itself? It's not any particular revealed truth. And it certainly doesn't seem to have much impact on his specific decisions. I think when you look around for some sort of theological explanation of why he's invaded Iraq or why he's taken the position he has in the Arab-Israeli conflict, you don't find it. It's not there. And I think also when you look at what he said about his religion, you find some real paradoxes and some real distortions. But it's a paradox. It's sincere, he believes, but at the same time, it's very calculated politically.
What's an example of a story that he's told about his religious life that you think is distorted?
Well, my favorite is the famous walk on the beach with Billy Graham. He's told the story. He tells it in A Charge to Keep, which is his campaign autobiography, about how he was up at Kennebunkport and Billy Graham said, "Are you right with God?" And Bush said, "No, but I'd like to be." And they took what Bush describes as a long walk on the beach and discussed Bush's problems. And he talks about how Billy Graham essentially was the messenger, how Billy Graham changed his life. Well, Billy Graham, when confronted with this story, was always a little bit befuddled because he clearly didn't remember anything like that happening. And at one point he said, by the way, there isn't actually any beach up there in Kennebunkport. So it wasn't clear where they would have taken a walk. But then I found an interesting source, which was a campaign book written for the religious book market in 1987 about George H.W. Bush when he was getting ready to run for president. And this was a book that was written by a man named Doug Weed. And it was an effort essentially to present George H.W. Bush, who had always been seen as a very secular figure, who revered the separation of church and state, to present him as appealing to the evangelicals. And in it, George W. Bush talks about Billy Graham and tells what's clearly the first version of this story, but there's no walk on the beach. It's a family conversation with Graham, and Bush talks about how later this had an impact on him. So I think I'm not sure that it's a conscious deception, but I think Bush has molded this kind of faith narrative for himself, which has significant anomalies in it. In fact, I think he did have a born-again experience. I think it was 3 years earlier, in 1984, in Midland, Texas, and it came at the hands of this interesting character named Arthur Blessett, who is a charismatic sort of Jesus freak who has been dragging an 11-foot cross around the world for
years. I should just
stop
and say, when you say Jesus freak, that was an expression that was used in the late 60s and early 70s to describe kind of hippie evangelical Christians. It was an expression from the period. You're not.
Yes,
using,
that's right.
Not using that as an insulting.
Terry, thank you for saving me for myself. I think that would have been a description that members of the Jesus movement would have applied to themselves. And in fact, Arthur Blessed preached in L.A. He had this famous ministry on the Sunset Strip and was known as the psychedelic minister. And it's funny. I read some of this literature. They very much present Jesus as an alternative to drugs, but using much of the same language about this is the life's greatest trip and so on.
How did George W. Bush meet Blessed?
He met Blessed. Blessed was an itinerant minister. I mean, as I said, he drags this enormous cross around the world. But he would give sort of revival-type meetings, particularly in the South, but around the country in big stadiums. And he was appearing in Midland over several days in 1984. And George W. Bush, according to the version I heard from a couple of people, was driving in his car around Midland, a time when things were not going well in the oil business, not going well in his life. And he heard Blessed on the radio. And he called a friend of his who he thought knew Blessed. And he said, I don't want to go to this big revival meeting with thousands and thousands of people, but I'd like to meet Blessed. And they met in the restaurant at the top of the Holiday Inn in Midland, Texas, with this friend and George W. Bush and Blessed. And they had a dialogue, which Blessed has actually written about. He has a website, and he records this in impressive detail. He seems to remember, but the details confirmed by the third person who was there. And the dialogue echoes almost precisely the dialogue that George W. Bush attributes to his conversation with Billy Graham.
Such as?
Are you right with God? No. Would you like to be? Yes. Do you accept Jesus as your personal savior? That's a little snippet of it. But you can the sequence is almost precisely the same.
So if you're saying that President Bush has presented his spiritual autobiography slightly differently than it actually happened, are you suggesting that his religion is insincere or that he's insincere in discussing his religion?
No. That I think is the paradox of it. I think it is both sincere and calculated. I think faith is very important to him. I think it did help him to change his life. I think he thinks it's very good for people, and he's supportive in a way of all religions. But he doesn't conform in all sorts of ways to the evangelical paradigm. He clearly doesn't believe in trying to convert other people, which most evangelicals do. Even his own family. He doesn't appear to have tried to interest his daughters, particularly in religion. He, after his religious conversion, he would still gamble, play poker. He was still drinking at that time. He swears. The president is quite profane. If you read various accounts, you'll get lots of examples of this. Most evangelicals don't swear. They tithe. They believe in giving 10% of their what they earn to charity. President Bush doesn't do that. There are all sorts of ways in which you look and you say, he's a born-again evangelical, but he doesn't do all of these things that born-again Christians do. And it's not that he is insincere or that it's fake. I think it's very real to him and it's become more important to him over time. At the same time, there is this element of political calculation that has been absolutely present from, I think, almost the moment of his conversion.
My guest is Jacob Weisberg, editor-in-chief of the online magazine Slate and author of the new book, The Bush Tragedy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jacob Weisberg. He's editor of the online magazine Slate and author of the new book, The Bush Tragedy. Now, you've been collecting Bushisms for many years and printing them in books and in Slate magazine. Just for anybody who isn't aware of it, explain what a Bushism is and give us a couple of classic examples.
When I started covering Bush during the 2000 campaign, I would hear these really funny mistakes come out of his mouth. And I started to collect them on Slate. I was at that point the chief political correspondent before I was editor. And we would put them up as Bushism of the day. This term has happily now entered the language. And, you know, Bushism was when Bush would say, "I know how hard it is to put food on your family." Or rarely is the question asked, "Is the children learning?" You know, that for some reason they have so many of them seem to involve education. But they were these malapropisms or spoonerisms, all kinds of misstatements. But in some ways, Terry, this is my penance for doing six collections of Bushisms, because I do think Bushisms give a misimpression of Bush. And the misimpression is that they make him sound like he's dumb. I have a quote from Bill Clinton in my book from around the time of the 2000 campaign. Clinton told people, and I think this was after Bush was reelected, "Bush doesn't know anything. He doesn't want to know anything. But he's not stupid." I don't think Bush is highly intelligent. I don't think he's highly literate. I don't think he's well-read. I think he's still on the low end of the spectrum of presidential intelligence. He has some particular kinds of intelligence that serve him very well. He has a strong interpersonal intelligence in that he reads people very quickly and very well and is actually very quick-witted in person. And he has a kind of political intelligence, which is that he simply responds and assimilates the political dynamic of issues very, very quickly and well. One of my favorite Bushisms, Terry, was when he was running 2000, Gail Sheehy wrote a piece in Vanity Fair that said, among other things, that he had dyslexia and that it was ran in the family. And Bush was asked for comment about it. And he said, "That woman who said I had dyslexia, I never interviewed her."
Now, you think that the Bush presidency has failed spectacularly, but you don't think he's guilty of impeachable offenses.
I don't. I think he's made bad mistakes, but I think I don't think he's committed high crimes and misdemeanors. I think it's probably pretty academic at this point anyway. There wouldn't be a lot of time left to impeach him. But no, I don't think we want to criminalize his error. I think we want to understand it, and at the same time, I think we want to give him a little sympathetic room. I mean, try to understand why this man made these kinds of decisions. Because I think when you look at this in the way I have, you end up in a position where you say nothing Bush did was surprising. If you understood the family relationships, if you understood his competition with his brother Jeb, if you understood the way he grew up in the shadow of his father, it all starts to be clear. And I think it was all certainly knowable by 2004, but mostly knowable in 2000. So in many ways, you have to ask, who's at fault here? Well, I think Bush is at fault for trying to do something beyond his basic capacities. I don't think he was capable of being a good president. But ultimately, I think you have to fault the people who elected him, not once but twice, because they should have known better and could have known better, certainly the second time, if not the first time.
Well, Bush started off incredibly popular, and now he's become an incredibly unpopular president. You're criticizing the American public for not having known better, for not being able to see the kinds of problems that you thought it was likely he would have. What conclusions does that lead you to reach about campaigning or elections or how people vote in the United States?
I think it makes me think that we need to understand people better. I think we understand candidates better, that character is very important, background is very important, family relationships are very important, and we have to try to understand these people beyond just the level of policy and politics.
But let me ask you, you say there should be more of an emphasis on people's background, who they are as people, but during the 2000 campaign between Bush and Gore, so much of it seemed to be not about policy, Gore was losing points for being perceived as too smart, too much like the smart kid in your class in grade school that you didn't like. And people said they wanted to go have a beer with George W. Bush. They seemed to like his personality, and a lot of people voted for him because of that. And Bush's personal story, particularly his spiritual story, was such an important part of who he was as a campaigner for president. There seemed to be very little emphasis on policy in some ways during that campaign.
Yeah, I covered Bush in 2000, and I had a positive personal reaction to him. I thought he'd be a good guy to have a beer with. Of course, it would have to be a non-alcoholic beer, which was his drink, in fact. But I think there's a difference between personality, affability, on the one hand, and character on the other. Understanding who someone is isn't the would you like to have a beer question, isn't the what are they really like question. It's a who are they really question. It's what do they believe? Why do they believe it? What formed them? What are they likely to do as president? It's a very hard thing to understand going forward. It's a much easier thing to understand looking back. But at the same time, I think we as voters owe it to ourselves to try to understand these people at the deepest level we can. And they give us a lot of clues. You know, campaigns are in many ways very superficial. But at the same time, over a lifetime of speaking and writing, candidates do leave some clues about who they really are. In the case of some of the candidates, I think of Barack Obama this time, who wrote this amazing autobiography at a very young age and has given us a way to understand him that you rarely can understand anyone in politics. With Hillary Clinton, it's a little harder, but the evidence is there. You just have to look for it.
Jacob Weisberg is the author of the new book, The Bush Tragedy, and editor-in-chief of the online magazine Slate. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, transforming an undertrained and under-equipped National Guard regiment into a fighting force in Iraq. We talk with Sean Michael Flynn about his new book, The Fighting 69th. And we talk with Slate magazine editor Jacob Weisberg about the primaries. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jacob Weisberg, editor-in-chief of the online magazine Slate, creator of the Bushisms series, and author of the new book, The Bush Tragedy. Well, the George W. Bush era is ending, so let's look ahead to what's coming next. Let's talk a little bit about the presidential primary season this year. Did you see the Democratic debate in Myrtle Beach Monday night that was shown on CNN. And Ma
I did, and
Blitzer.
I think that was of the debates I've watched. There have been a tremendous number of them this time, but it was fun to watch because it was so aggressive. You know, we've known that Hillary Clinton was going to go after Obama, that she was going to go negative on him, but I was surprised by the extent of it, the harshness of it, and then by John Edwards piling on. I think I've assumed that. Obama was Edwards' second choice, and that at some point I think he's likely to get out of the race. And I sort of assumed he might get out in favor of Obama. But it sure didn't look like that on Monday night.
So much of the debate and the news-making aspect of the debate on Monday was about the feud between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, as opposed to policy differences. And in some ways, I think people are a lot more interested in the feuds because it's kind of like a soap opera. It's kind of like a TV miniseries where there's people fighting with each other and like who's quarreling with who, as opposed to following nuances in policy, which are difficult to follow. It requires reading more carefully. It's not fun in the way a soap opera is fun. And I guess I've been trying to figure out how much of this infighting is coming from the candidates themselves and how much is it that the media is focusing on this. Particularly, you know, some of the TV media, because it is so dramatic. And if that's what makes news, maybe you do more of it because that's what gets you the attention.
Yeah. I think policy as a subject in presidential campaigns has had a kind of independent career. The high watermark was 1992, when really all of the candidates had very, very detailed policy positions. In some ways, Ross Perot kicked that off. But you remember that was the year Bill Clinton put out this book, Putting People First, which had really impressively detailed policy positions in all sorts of areas. And in many ways, having Paul Tsongas do the same thing on the Democratic side, and in many ways, having detailed policy platform was kind of the price of admission to being taken seriously as a candidate. I thought that was very good. But at the same time, if you look back at Bill Clinton's policy document from 1992, things worked out pretty differently, and they always do. There's a lot of policy that can only be made in consultation with Congress. You know, president under our system doesn't get elected and implement his platform. So I think in many ways it's possible to overestimate policy because you are not – just because you vote for the candidate doesn't mean you're going to get the policy they support. In fact, a candidate with a different policy may be in a better position on something like healthcare to implement or get past something closer to what you want. But at the same time, I share some of your dismay that policy has been de-emphasized to the extent it has. I think there's been less policy in every campaign since 1992, and I personally would like to see a lot more of it.
You've covered political campaigns. Do you think that the primary season has gotten completely out of control, that it's much too long, there's so many debates, and everybody who is campaigning can't really be doing their job as, you know, what they've been elected to do?
I think the primary system has become absolutely indefensible in a number of ways. I mean, even before it got so out of hand in terms of the early starts, I think it was very hard to defend in principle giving such disproportionate power to two states, to Iowa and New Hampshire. And I think that remains true. But this time, because of that, the unwillingness, particularly on the Democratic side, to challenge the primacy, the traditional primacy of those two states, you've ended up disenfranchising voters. I mean, in Michigan and in Florida, the Democratic Party has decided that it's essentially not going to count the votes of the primary voters because these states have decided to give themselves a shot at mattering. And for Democrats to disenfranchise voters in Florida after what happened in 2000, I mean, I think it's terrible to disenfranchise voters anywhere. But I think the system is beyond broken. I think it's a travesty. And of course, it goes on much too long for all sorts of reasons.
Religion is an interesting issue in the Republican primary. You know, Mike Huckabee is the only candidate who describes himself as an evangelical, yet he hasn't won the support of the older evangelical leadership. And some people say he's kind of like a wedge between the two generations of evangelicals. And, you know, Mitt Romney is Mormon. I guess I want to refer to an article that you wrote in Slate a little over a year ago, in which you were writing about Romney's religion and whether that should be an issue or not. And let me just read a little bit of what you wrote there.
Sure.
You wrote, "If Romney gets anywhere in the primaries, religion will become an issue with moderate and secular voters, and rightly so. Objecting to someone because of his religious beliefs is not the same thing as prejudice based on religious heritage, race, or gender. Not applying a religious test for public office means that people of all faiths are allowed to run, not that views about God, creation, and the moral order are inadmissible for political debate." Would you expand on that a little bit and talk about what you think is admissible and inadmissible in talking about a politician's religion and using their religion to help you decide whether to vote for them or not?
Yesterday, I was going to say, even though I wrote that a year ago, I still think it. I think what I was reacting to at that point was Romney's very early gestures to say that it was Mormonism should be off the table. It was outrageous for anyone to say that that could be a factor in their vote. And I think politicians want to have it both ways on this score. They want to appeal to religious voters on a religious basis. They want to present themselves as religious people the way it helps them. But they want to be immune from any kind of criticism or question about their religious beliefs. And I think you have to draw a distinction between objecting to someone based on who they are, what religion they were born in, which is a kind of prejudice or discrimination, as opposed to evaluating somebody's views. And I think one of the lessons from the Bush presidency is that someone's beliefs matter, whether they're philosophical beliefs, religious beliefs, or how all of those things work together. And all religious views are not equal. I mean, I would tend to be very skeptical of anybody who had any kind of fundamentalist or literal-minded belief in any religion, and particularly I would be skeptical of someone who was a member of a cult or a young religion that doesn't have a kind of long tradition of evolving into sort of metaphor and developing sort of reform as well as fundamentalist wings.
In your estimation, people didn't pay enough attention to George W. Bush's religion in 2000 when he was elected the first time.
I think that's right. And I think what's most important about it is, again, not the theology, because there's not very much theology there, but the fact that religion is part of the way he decides things peremptorily. Because he sees things very, very simply in terms of right and wrong, because he has a simple moralistic outlook on the world, I think he uses religion. One of the ways he uses religion unproductively is to avoid debate, discussion, deep thinking, reconsideration. It helps him jump to a conclusion. And I think understanding the way his mind works and the way he uses religion as a kind of crutch for that, I think is something we should have understood better.
Jacob Weisberg, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Jared. It's a pleasure.
Jacob Weisberg is the editor-in-chief of the online magazine Slate and author of the new book, The Bush Tragedy. Coming up, Sean Flynn of the Fighting 69th talks about taking a National Guard unit from New York into battle in Iraq. This is Fresh Air. New York's Fighting 69th is one of many National Guard units that has been called up for duty in Iraq. My guest, Sean Michael Flynn, commanded two rifle companies in the 69th and now has written a new book called The Fighting 69th, One Remarkable National Guard Unit's Journey from Ground Zero to Baghdad. The Fighting 69th was famous as a largely Irish unit with a distinguished combat record, But by 2001, Flynn says this unit was a multicultural group comprised largely of immigrants and New Yorkers from the lower economic classes. Flynn writes, most had no prior military experience and no intention of serving their country any longer than it took to get a paycheck or college credit or job training. Their uniforms are often incomplete and worn to look better in the hood than in the wood. Black two-pack bandanas instead of helmets, low-riding camouflage pants, unlaced boots. When they marched, it was more of a pimp roll or gangster limp. If they didn't feel like doing army duties, they'd tell you to stick it. Sean Michael Flynn, welcome to Fresh Air. What was the Fighting 69th's reputation before it was activated in 9/11, after 9/11?
I think some people didn't think the Fighting 69th could get out of its own way. It was underfunded. It was ill-equipped. It was short of soldiers and short of a lot of the key qualified leaders that any military unit needs to have in place to perform effectively.
You write, the unit had allowed too many old, out-of-shape, and drug-using men in its ranks, making whatever accommodations were necessary to keep soldiers on the roll. So what were the men in the ranks like?
Well, that was the opinions of one of the captains that I interviewed for the book. And he had come from another unit where the quality of the soldiers and the equipment was at a higher level. And he was shocked when he came into the Fighting 69th and saw that the soldiers were not of the same caliber.
The way you describe it, most of the men in the Fighting 69th really didn't expect to be called on to defend New York after September 11th, didn't expect to be sent to Iraq. They expected to report for duty, was it once a month?
1 weekend a month and 2 weeks every summer. That's the catchphrase.
Yeah, and hopefully to get some college tuition payments and so on. But, you know, that's not the way it worked out. After September 11th, once the men were called on to participate in the defense of New York, what was the reaction within the Fighting 69th at being, you know, really called on to respond?
Nobody hesitated to respond to September 11th. Everybody was there. This was New York City. This was our backyard. And everybody went to the armory without a call, put their gear together, and worked their way down to Ground Zero with the battalion. But following that, as weeks turned into months, turned into years of homeland security duty in the New York City area and also at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, a lot of the soldiers said, well, wait a minute, now, this isn't what I signed up for. I was there for Ground Zero. I helped that. I was there for 9/11. That was the crisis. But this year of duty is not what I signed up for, and maybe I need to rethink my membership in the National Guard. And about 30% of the soldiers wound up leaving the National Guard at that time.
How did you feel about taking into battle a battalion of men who weren't trained for it and who you describe as being not prepared?
You know, the commander of the 69th had written a newsletter to the force prior to going to Iraq, and he said, don't worry, the Army will prepare us. You will be more prepared for Iraq than you can ever imagine. But in fact, as we got closer to getting on the plane to fly to the Middle East, it occurred to him that we're not ready. We are not as ready as I thought we would be. And that went through the minds, I think, of all the units. We all wanted more training, and we all wanted to be better and have more equipment. You know, more is better, I guess, is what we were thinking. But at the end of the day, we had to go.
What were you lacking in terms of training and equipment?
The equipment actually was not a significant issue. By 2004, when the Fighting 69th went to Iraq, the military-industrial complex had really ramped up to start getting armor and new helmets and body armor out to the soldiers. So we didn't lack in that regard. We got it all new as we were getting ready to go over. What we lacked, though, was the time to train on that equipment because it was coming in so fast. We were never training on it. And you know, though as an infantry company commander, I may wanted to have trained my men on how to properly attack an insurgent force inside of a building. Instead, I might have to focus on, well, how do we use this new radio that we just got?
So were you in the position of having to explain to the soldiers why they didn't get the training they were promised and why they had to fight anyways?
Yes. All of the leadership in the Fighting 69th found themselves in the middle of Kuwait, getting ready to drive north into the middle of Baghdad for a fight that none of them thought would ever take place, for a mission none of them thought the National Guard would ever do. And the soldiers looked and said, where is the rest of the training that we need to do this? And we had to look at them in the eye and say, we've got what we've got, but we've got to go forward and give it our best.
One of the missions that the Fighting 69th had was in Taji. What was the mission there?
Taji is a rural area about 25 miles north of Baghdad. Like most of the areas around Iraq, it was very heavily canaled for use by farming. It had houses kind of remotely spread out here and there. And the job of the Fighting 69th was essentially to secure that area so that the insurgents didn't go into there and lob rockets and mortars into the big major bases inside of Baghdad. And the 69th was effective. Even without a traditional battle handover like most units were receiving, the 69th was able to go out and just by driving around the roads and putting themselves in the area, that immediately reduced that indirect fire attack. But it certainly created other problems.
Like?
What you might refer to as roadside bombs, which in Taji, we did not have roadside bombs as much as we had roadbed bombs. An explosion did not go off on the side of the road. The entire road blew up with massive amounts of explosive power, far greater than any of our armored vehicles, whether they be armored Humvees or even very heavily armored Bradley fighting vehicles, could resist. The nature of those explosives could defeat absolutely any piece of equipment that the U.S. Army had in Iraq.
What was the worst hit you took?
2 years ago, and this month in 2005, the 69th lost a fully loaded Bradley fighting vehicle with seven soldiers inside. It was driving down a rural road alongside of a canal, a road that we had to use because there were only a handful of roads. So the enemy could probably guess that we would be there, and he did, and he guessed well. And he hit that armored vehicle, destroying it completely, tossing several tons of steel and armor and soldiers through the air till it was upside down in a canal. And it was such a powerful charge that, very much like September 11th, we had to use ultimately DNA samples to confirm the casualties on board that vehicle.
What was the reaction of the men to this attack? I mean, these were men who hadn't signed up for full service in the military. They just signed up for the National Guard. And after an attack like this, where you can't even identify the remains of the soldiers, did they want to continue fighting, or did they feel like, why are we here?
I think you saw a little bit of both. In that first 2 months of combat in Iraq, the Fighting 69th lost 10 soldiers. And several men had to decide whether or not they were going to be able to handle this. Some men cracked under the pressure and had to be reassigned or taken out of key positions. After we lost the Bradley, even the commander of the Fighting 69th was shaken to the point where he said, I wasn't sure that I could send the unit back out into the field, because he believed that sending one more patrol outside into rural Iraq was a death sentence for the soldiers. It was the soldiers themselves who walked into his office and said, sir, we're going to go back out, and we're going to go back out hard. And I think there's a point in warfare where soldiers realize that they could die at any moment. And the men of the 69th realized very quickly that they could die at any moment, and they had two choices. They could either get over it, or they could curl up into a fetal position and no longer perform.
So were they successful in striking back?
They were, but success is always limited in insurgent warfare. You know, it's not as if you were taking a line, or, you know, we've captured such and such a town, and the enemy is now on the other side of the river. It's not as clear-cut as that. What the Fighting 69th did to respond was pour every single soldier and piece of equipment they had into that area of Taji. They went without sleep. They went without rest for days and days and days and beat the brushes, asking, trying to find out where the enemy was and trying to stay so omnipresent that the enemy did not have a chance to strike back. It was a successful operation because, again, they were not attacking the big bases with mortars and rockets, and it reduced their amount or their ability to attack the 69th with IEDs.
My guest is Sean Michael Flynn, author of the new book, The Fighting 69th. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sean Michael Flynn, author of the new book, The Fighting 69th. Flynn commanded two rifle companies in the Fighting 69th, a New York National Guard unit that he describes as undertrained and under-equipped for battle. But in 2004, they were sent to Iraq, where, among other things, they fought insurgents in Taji, near Baghdad. After Taji, the Fighting 69th was assigned to guard the road that became known as the most dangerous road in the world, the road from the Baghdad airport to the Green Zone. And it sounds like that was actually a very transformative experience for the Fighting 69th. In what way?
The battalion entered Iraq lacking the training that it fully wanted, and it had all that on-the-job combat training, which was a very costly way to go to war in Iraq. By the time we got to Route Irish, however, that we now had the training, and the Fighting 69th was at the least on par with any other active duty battalion now serving in Iraq. So the unit and the men who were so concerned in Kuwait, who were scared about the unit's level of training and who were scared about its leadership, now had a chance to see the unit fully trained and to have seen its leaders, those that made it through Taji, functioning. And they now had confidence in themselves and confidence in their leadership. And they did not have that confidence going into Iraq. It was only 3 months into the war that that confidence started to reach the soldiers. And that took place on Route Irish, and it made the Fighting 69th a very effective combat unit. And the men took a lot of pride in their capabilities on that road.
During the period that you write about, which ends in 2006, how many men did the Fighting 69th lose in Iraq?
19 soldiers out of approximately 750. And another 85 were wounded. And those are fairly steep numbers for this war, and perhaps among the highest in any National Guard unit that deployed overseas. It was a costly fight. And those are just the combat casualties, because back at home, the war took its toll on the people as well. two of my platoon leaders, in fact, lost their marriages during that time period. And that was a regular occurrence throughout the battalion. So whatever stresses people had at home were exacerbated by the war. So the casualties from that tour were high.
How have the men who are under your command done since returning home?
They've done very well. Certainly, some soldiers have had some issues. You know, there are some soldiers who have signs of post-traumatic stress disorder, and who are being treated for that. But the number is very small, and there are some soldiers who are wounded, some severely, who are doing great. I had a soldier that worked very closely with me, who lost the use of his left arm and most of his left arm in the process, and he's now running triathlons. And I'm impressed. They're not just even Paralympic triathlons, but these are triathlons that you and I are running, and he's placing, and he only has the use of one of his arms. So it's, you know, so the soldiers are doing great across the board, in my opinion, though I don't think a day goes by where any of them think about their tour and think about the cost and the their friends that they left behind.
Is there any chance that the men who serve with you from the National Guard Battalion of the Fighting 69th will be redeployed and sent back to Iraq?
More than 300 soldiers of the Fighting 69th are, as we speak, headed towards Afghanistan or about to head towards Afghanistan. Among those soldiers are men who served at Ground Zero, who did homeland defense duty in and around the United States, who went to Iraq, and they're now going on to Afghanistan. Every soldier who served in Iraq in the Fighting 69th and who is now going to Afghanistan volunteered to go.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much, Terry. It's been my pleasure.
Sean Michael Flynn is the author of The Fighting 69th. He's now a captain in the Army National Guard. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable. On the web at grdodge.org. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And from Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching, at breakthroughcollaborative.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Library of America has just published a collection of the early novels and stories of the late writer William Maxwell. John Updike once called Maxwell's writing voice one of the wisest and kindest in American fiction. On the next Fresh Air, we listen to our 1995 interview with Maxwell. Join us for the next Fresh Air.